Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me again today. I am your host, John Naster. We have quite the fantastic guest for you today, and I'm really, really excited to bring her and this conversation I got to have with her to you. And I hope you enjoy it just nearly even as much as I did. So without further ado, let's get into it. My guest today, she's an author of a brand new book called Digital Goddess, and she's a CEO and an entrepreneur who uses her anxiety to her advantage. Since 2007, she's been the co-founder and CEO of Big Think. It's a media company and education company focused on short-form digital and immediately actionable content. Most recently, though, as I said, she's written this book, and it's called Digital Goddess, Unfiltered Lessons of a Female Entrepreneur. Now, let's hack. Victoria Montgomery Brown. Let's face it, 2020 hasn't been a normal year. But if you own a small business, 2020 could be the year that you switch to better payroll. Gusto wasn't just built for small businesses, it was built for the people behind them, you and me. Their online payroll is super, super easy to use. And with Gusto, you can automatically calculate paychecks and file all your payroll taxes, which means you have time to run your business. Join over the 100,000 businesses that Gusto already helps with tasks like automated payroll tax filing, simple direct deposits, free health insurance administration, 401k onboarding tools, you name it, Gusto made it easy. Here's the best part. Because you are a listener of Hack the Entrepreneur, you get 3 months totally free. All you have to do is go to gusto.com/hack. That's gusto, gusto.com/hack. I'm telling you, you're going to love Gusto, so go get started today and get 3 months free. Let's stop and pretend for a moment that you're about to launch a campaign. It's tested well. Your team is completely happy. Everything is going according to plan, except for that one nagging thought in the back of your head. How do I ensure people I want to target will be in the mindset to receive my message? The answer? LinkedIn. Because when you market on LinkedIn, your message reaches people who are ready to do business. And that means your advertising campaign will work as hard as it can as soon as you launch it. And this works so well because over 62 million decision makers are on LinkedIn. And while they're there, they're thinking about their business. Doing business on LinkedIn, the world's largest professional network, can help you reach your marketing goals. Do business where business is done. Get a $100 advertising credit towards your first LinkedIn campaign. Visit linkedin.com/hack. That's linkedin.com/hack. Terms and conditions apply. And we are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur. And today we have a very, very, very special guest. Victoria, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you. I've been looking forward to this and I'm excited to get going. So let's just jump into it, shall we?
Let's.
Cool. Let's start here, Victoria. Victoria, as an entrepreneur, what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
Well, I'm not sure that the audience is going to love this answer, but I would say that my anxiety is a differentiator in a bad way and also a good way, because it certainly drives me to do things that I might not otherwise do, but it also causes a lot of mental anxiety. But I think if you were to ask those around me, the number one differentiator for me is my level of anxiety, which is not something that I per se do, but it is something that I have that is unique, probably.
Wow. Okay. So I've asked this question over 500 times. I have never had that answer, or even remotely. Like, can you give us an example of how you use, because I know people are listening and being like, I can't leave the house when I'm under anxiety like that. But give us an example. How does this benefit you?
I would say it benefits me by driving me to take action. So I know a lot of people who suffer from anxiety, it paralyzes them. For me to get through it, it actually catalyzes me to start acting. And that's the way that I can get out of my head. And so in the case of starting Big Think 13 years ago, I think if I had just allowed the concept of being an entrepreneur to sink in versus just taking action, I might not have done it. But the once I had it in my head, and my business partner had it in his head that we wanted to create Big Think, the only thing that I could do, because I was already anxious about the idea of it, was dive in and start making it happen. So that's a huge motivating factor in my life. Do I wish sometimes I didn't have such anxiety? Yes, but I also think it's been, for me, a blessing.
Okay, so that's cool. So I like that perspective on it, because it's one of those survivorship sort of biases we can put to it, because you've been very successful. And to say your anxiety helps you is great, but 13 years ago, you probably wouldn't have given me that same answer. You would have said it might be what will hold you back.
I think that is probably true. And then after we had spoken, I probably would have thought, oh my God, I need to take action. So I might have said something different, but I probably would have behaved in the same way. I don't have tips that I can identify myself that I do on a daily basis that are different than any other entrepreneur might do, which I think is maybe what you are asking me to identify. I think that really it's the drive of anxiety is something that has been fundamental to this.
Right. Okay, so this is fascinating to me. I like this. And I think we can possibly help some people listening with this. So like it's 2020, there's a pandemic going on. It's the mental health pressures and aspect of it are huge. And then also starting, running, growing a business has a lot of mental health strain on it. How, or would you say that like that mental health aspect of business of life and sort of like making sure you find a work-life balance within all of this is essential to this?
I would say that it is essential. And I would honestly say that I have not had a work-life balance for the majority of the time being CEO and co-founder of Big Think. And it's something that if I were to do it again, I would take steps to ensure that I did. So yes, anytime you're running a business or an entrepreneur or whatever, there is a mental health aspect to it that one ought to take care of. And I have not been a good example of that. And what's interesting is that you bring up the concept of mental health, especially during a time of pandemic. For me, bizarrely, I've actually found myself to be less anxious during this time because I feel there are so many other people similarly situated that it's actually somewhat of a comfort. And that is a bizarre thing to say and probably not PC, but it has been the case for me. I feel that everybody is in a highly heightened state of anxiety. And people can relate. I can relate to that in people, and that gives me some sense of comfort as well.
That's true. That's an interesting way to look at it. And I think even just more people are admitting to it. So it's not such a hidden, veiled issue amongst even like the most successful people around us are in many ways admitting to these types of things because it's been a crazy year. And so it's hard for any of us to sort of avoid that. With this work-life balance and like learning about it now, 13 years later or 10 or whenever it was throughout this, but with the successes you've had, like, can you pinpoint any of that to the fact that you just worked hard and didn't worry about that work-life balance at the time?
Yes. I think that a large reason for my success has been the fact that I prioritized work above all else. and has got us through. I mean, so if we were having rough times with Big Think business-wise or something like that, I would put everything else to the side and plow through, like with blinders on. And for sure, that drove some of our success. And it also drove some of my own personal unsuccesses. I mean, when I started Big Think in 2000 and working on it in 2006, I had a boyfriend and was living with somebody and got engaged. And 4 years later, that marriage dissolved because my entire focus had been on Big Think, probably necessarily at certain points, but unnecessarily at other points. So I'm not trying to be a cautionary tale to entrepreneurs out there, because you do have to put everything into it. But there is no need to destroy your own, I think, relationships to have a successful business.
Right. Okay. Very well said. So 2006, you and a co-founder decide to start Big Think. What was sort of the catalyst or vision of this at that point?
Absolutely. So we both worked in media and we saw a dearth of thoughtful content on the internet. So YouTube had just popped up right around 2006, I think, and video on the internet was becoming somewhat of a regular thing that people were looking at. And so we thought, you know what? There are all these incredible experts around the world, people like Richard Branson, Nobel laureates, Elon Musk, what have you, that only elite other people have access to their wisdom if they're not on the news or something like that. And it's by and large, when you see them on the news and stuff, it's not evergreen content. It's them commenting on what's going on in their business or what's going on in the economy or society, et cetera. And we thought, wait a second, all of these incredible experts, whether they be athletes or what have you, have such wisdom to share that can help you or I personally and professionally. And why don't we start asking those type of people questions that would yield some evergreen content about making our lives better personally and professionally, short form video content. And so when we were starting Big Think, we needed investment. And so we obviously needed some type of way to convince people to invest in Big Think. So the way that we pitched it to our initial investors was the concept of Davos Democratized. And for those of us out there who don't know what Davos was, and I certainly didn't years ago, it's an annual event that takes place in the Alps where notable people like Bono and world leaders and business people, essentially people who are changing the way that we work and live, gather to talk about what's going on in the world and share wisdom. And so we thought, well, why don't we want to share what these type of experts have to say with an audience who can put it into practice, not just other elite audiences. So to our initial investors, that was the concept, Davos Democratized, share the wisdom of incredible people with a much wider audience in a way that is evergreen and short form, and that they can put it into practice. And the way that we talk about our content that we create is that it has to be significant, relevant, and actionable. And so it's not just about a moment in time. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Yes, it did. Davos Democratized is a great pitch. It's a great way to wrap it up. I like that. So correct me if I'm wrong, but Big Think was your first company you started.
That is right, yes. And the first company of my business partner as well.
Oh, wow. So how did it become apparent as you were even preparing to launch that you needed funding to do this?
Well, because we knew that we needed funding, because to build a website and to start filming people, we needed production equipment, we needed developers to build the website. So it wasn't just, you know, the time of the iPhone or whatever, where you could probably just start a business today with just your phone. We actually needed infrastructure. And so buying camera equipment back then was expensive. Building websites in 2007 was super expensive. And we also had fantastical ideas of what we wanted our website to be. It didn't end up being that way. In fact, it was sort of not a precursor to Zoom. We had this notion of interviewing people through our computers and capturing that on video and putting it on our website. anyway, that was 2007. So you imagine the technology was not sophisticated. So it was a difficult thing for us to achieve. But the fundamental reason we needed to raise money is because back then, this infrastructure was considerably expensive. And so we couldn't have just created it without the funds.
Right. How has the vision for Big Think changed in the past 13 years?
I would say that we've held true to our mission, which has been to help people get smarter faster. That's actually the mantra or the mission of Big Think that everybody who's at Big Think knows. And while the format of the content that we've created has evolved and grown and will continue to do so, I would say that fundamental mission hasn't changed. It's just about, what does that mean today? What does being smarter, faster today mean versus what it might have meant 13 years ago?
Okay. Obviously technology, like as you said, with the creation of the content itself, I mean, creating or starting a business like Big Think today is in some ways much, much easier and in other ways much, much more difficult. But the technology aspect of it is definitely a lot easier.
I think so. I mean, we reach over 40 million people a month across our platforms, and it's significant reach. And I don't know today if we started Big Think that we would have been able to achieve that, because quite honestly, and I'm not an expert on media, capturing eyeballs today, I think, is more difficult than ever before, because there are so many things that our eyeballs could be captured by. And I would be really daunted if I were starting a website or media company today, because I just don't know, without massive amounts of funding, how you could build an audience. Seriously, and you know, to make money off of websites today, you need so much traffic if you're going to go the advertising or sponsorship route that I think it would be overwhelming to start one today.
It would, yes. It can still be done, but I think people definitely have to go more sort of like niche down into more specific things to really get their sort of get a grip in the marketplace if they can. So just saying, like, I mean, you have a ton of traffic, a ton of eyeballs on your content now, and you mentioned sort of the monetization. Can you just sort of fill us in? Like, what are the main sort of monetization methods of Big Think at this point?
Absolutely. So initially, when we started Big Think, the entire monetization was sponsorship. So to the point where, you know, we did not have any traffic when we launched Big Think. Mm-hmm. So advertising would not really have been viable, because it would have yielded almost no money. And so back then, branded content and sponsored content was sort of just popping up on the internet. And we figured a sort of PBS model on the internet where we could bring content to our audience free by getting sponsorships. And so it was never advertorial content. It was content that we would have created anyway. So for example, I'll give you an example. One of our first clients was Intel. And from soup to nuts, Big Think's job was to come up with the concept of what the sponsorship would be, get the experts who would be a part of the series, video series, and then distribute it. So initially it was pretty simple, but the Intel, one of our first sponsorships, as I said, was this concept of moments of genius, where we had people come on who had done something extraordinary or continued to do something extraordinary. And they talk about what was the moment that catalyzed them to do it. So for instance, we had Elon Musk on talking about him building SpaceX and Tesla. This was years and years ago. And then also the fellow, I'm forgetting his name, the doctor who identified the HIV virus. And so it was sponsored content, but it was also through storytelling. And we still do that today. So all of the content that you see on Big Think, whether it's sponsored or not, is content that we would have created otherwise, but we needed a way to support the free content that we were bringing to our audience. In more recent years, as our traffic has grown, we've started to put ads on the site, probably most fundamentally in the last 2 years, because we really didn't want to disturb the audience with tons and tons of ads. But to keep the site going, we have needed to do that. And so once the traffic was significant enough, we did that as well. We also have two other business models, which evolved over time. So as we were creating content for the likes of Intel and stuff like that and sponsored content, some organizations we were working with on sponsored content said, what you're doing for us externally is great, but we have real internal learning and development needs. And people want to learn from people who are doing extraordinary things, not like a middle manager in a dimly lit conference room or something like that. And so could you help us create learning and development content that would inspire and provide results for people within our organization? And so we developed something called Big Think Edge, which still exists today, to help employees at all levels of an organization to grow personally and professionally. So it's soft skill type content, leadership, unconscious bias, that type of stuff with the experts that we have on the public side of Big Think. But this content is created specifically for that mission. And it's a license. So organizations license that content for their employees. And because we are a relatively small organization, we were really focused on the B2B market for that product. And in the last couple of years, individuals have been coming to us and saying, hey, we understand that you're creating this type of learning content for organizations. Can we get a B2C version of it? So we've created a B2C, which is business to consumer, for individual version of Big Think Edge. So those are the ways we monetize the content that we create today. And then there's also the ability for organizations to license some of our public content, and we have distribution deals with LinkedIn Learning and Cornerstone and others. So we really try to get every piece of meat off the carcass because we want to continue our mission. And obviously as a business, we need to make money. So it's an evolving business model, and I'm sure it will continue to evolve as we grow.
Exactly. Yeah. And I like that you have just multiple different like streams of revenue. And it from the outside, at least, and from your brief description of it, Victoria, it seems like it's almost, if not all of it, sort of like online based, meaning you were potentially less drastically impacted by COVID and this pandemic than a lot of companies were.
I think that's true. Organizations that we, or companies that we have licensed content to, that has been somewhat of a challenge. It's bouncing back because people, organizations and companies realize that keeping their employees educated, especially now, is more important than ever. So when it first hit, the temptation was to cut as soon as anywhere that they could because they didn't know how long this would last, what the implications would be, etc. So learning and development is often one of the first things to be cut from budgets inside companies. So there was a fear that that would happen, and initially it did. But that is all changing because, as I said, educating people, especially in the time of working from home and figuring out how to communicate with your team and your colleagues, et cetera, is so important that it's actually been helpful to us over the longer term. As I said initially, it was a real concern for us that these budgets would be just slashed. And they were for a time being, but it's coming back.
Right. And you're right. Like things, I mean, obviously, end of March, early April, things were, everybody just stopped everything for a bit, and then it has come back. Well, unless you're in the restaurant business or travel business, still quite slow, I think, at this time. But as somebody who earlier on, you're speaking about the work-life balance, how you necessarily didn't always have it, and how you're working more towards having that. And now you are getting ready to, I'm only bringing that up because you've decided to write a book, which takes a ton of work. So somebody who is the CEO and co-founder of a company already decides to take on a massive project, which is a lot of work. But the book is done and the book is ready to come out. So the book is Digital Goddess, The Unfiltered Lessons of a Female Entrepreneur. I would love to know, Victoria, how did you decide that now, probably 2 years ago when you did this, that you decided that writing a book right now in your position was the right thing to do?
Well, interestingly enough, my business partner, Peter Hopkins, the co-founder of Big Think, has been saying to me for a number of years, you have such an interesting story. There are a ton of male founders out there and increasingly number of women founders, but I think your story is unique and you probably have something to share, especially with aspiring women entrepreneurs, but also with anybody who's aspiring to be an entrepreneur and also anybody in business, I hope. And so he was the initial catalyst to get me to write the book. And then along the way, before I started writing, young women did start writing to me, emailing me, calling me, LinkedIning me or whatever, to ask for my advice. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I do have something to say, because as you know, and I'm sure, you know, every audience knows, it's not easy to understand what wisdom we have to share. Other people might be able to identify that for us. But when I'm talking to other entrepreneurs, I'm not necessarily sure that what I have to say is going to be helpful to them. But as I got asked increasingly over the years, I began to feel a little more confident. And so the steps that I took were to initially write a proposal, because I wasn't going to write a whole book if I submitted it to a potential agent or publisher and they thought that there was no there. And so I wrote a proposal actually in, my gosh, when was it? It was January of 2018, maybe? No, sorry, 2019. So a year ago. And then I just sort of put it on the shelf and managed to get an agent in June of 2019 and spoke to him about it. And he said, you know what, Victoria, we're going to submit your proposal to 10 publishers and we'll see what they say. So I sort of put it out of my mind. And by the way, in a book proposal, you write what you think the market might be for the book, who the potential audience might be. And then generally you write a chapter or two. And a lot of people decide to write the whole book, but I didn't decide to do that. And so I had those two chapters and the potential market for it set up. The agent submitted it to 10 publishers. 9 of the 10 of them said no. And so I just thought, oh my gosh, well, this is probably going nowhere. The 10th one said yes, yay for HarperCollins, thank you. And then they said, okay, well, it's now September of 2019. So not that long ago, a year ago from right now. And they said, okay, given that there's going to be election upcoming, et cetera, we want you to write this book by November 1st of last year. So I was like, well, that seems like a very tight deadline. Perhaps I can do it. I managed to convince them that I could have until December 1st to write it. So I had I wrote the whole book in basically 2.5 months. Wow. And again, this is something that I think my anxiety fueled me. If they had given me a year to write it, I might not have done it. But given the sort of cram for exam or you have to write your paper and you haven't done it, that really drove me to write this thing. And the timeline was incredibly helpful. So it was essentially finished in December of 2019. So it hasn't been that long, actually.
Wow, that's impressive. You just use the deadline and just get it done. That's all you can do sometimes, I guess. The subtitle, The Unfiltered Lessons of a Female Entrepreneur. I'm not going to ask you for all of them because you probably don't remember them all, even though it's only been a year. But could you give us one of these lessons?
So specifically for women or for men? I mean, I would
say... Let's go for women. This is for female entrepreneurs, right?
Okay, yes. So I would say one of the biggest and most important lessons I've learned, which has helped me in the workplace and also in my personal life, is the concept of trying harder to be softer. So when I initially started Big Think, I had the notion in my head that the CEO, founder, et cetera, had to be really tough as nails. So as I write about in the book, the concept of command and control is something that's in the military. And that is not, I have found at least, an effective way to run a business, because you want as much input from anybody who's working with you and for them to feel like they can freely say what they think might make the business better or is affecting them in their work, et cetera. And so initially, I think I was pretty rigid and tough. And as I evolved over the years, really changed that. And I'm not that type of leader anymore at all. I think I'm kind of a softie. Now, do I need to be stern at times? Absolutely. And require performance. But you can do that in a way that is a lot softer than I started out in the beginning. And I think that's something that a lot of women think they have to put on their big boy pants or whatever to be a CEO. And no, there are major advantages to being a woman in business. And I think using the softness that women naturally have is a good thing in leadership.
I love that. I love that. And I would like to comment on it, but I don't think I can because I'm not a woman in business. And so I don't know what it feels like, but I love that idea of like trying harder to be softer. And I guess you can be more of yourself. You don't have to try and be that other side of things if that doesn't come naturally to you.
Absolutely.
In your opinion, like how are female entrepreneurs reshaping business in 2020?
Well, I spoke to this incredible woman last week or 2 weeks ago named Tiffany Pham, who started a company named Mogul, and it's doing incredibly well. And what she has done is built an incredible business. And what she has also done is start a fund to invest in other businesses. So I think women entrepreneurs these days have a great opportunity to not only build their businesses, but something that I would like to do eventually is what Tiffany Pham has done is invest in other businesses. So I think it's now becoming a little bit more of a rolling stone versus one-offs. Women are helping other women build businesses as well. So female entrepreneurs are helping other female entrepreneurs, which I think is a really exciting thing. And I just think there's so much opportunity today for women to start businesses. And if I would encourage women to do that, and now I'm completely rambling, but there you go.
You weren't at all. All right, Victoria. Well, I don't want to take much more of your time, but I've really thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. I would love to wrap up on one final question for you if I could.
Absolutely.
So it's this idea I've been working with calling the entrepreneurial gap. I've interviewed over 500 people at this point, and it's this thing I notice with entrepreneurs as dreamers. We constantly seem to push our own personal and business successes into the future. So no matter what we accomplish personally and professionally, we always think that when we hit that next metric, when your book hits that next bestseller list, that's when you'll see yourself as successful. Yet, Victoria, you and I both know right before you hit that, you're just going to set bigger, loftier goals. And there's a place for that. And I agree that that is something we need to push us forward. But rather than looking forward right now, Victoria, I would love it if you could stop and turn around and look behind you. I mean, you've been building Big Think for 13 years now. We've heard parts of it, but we haven't heard all of the highs and lows, wins and losses. But could you tell me, how do you feel about this journey up until today?
I feel extraordinarily blessed about this journey. When I look back in the moment, I probably didn't appreciate so many of the wonderful things that were happening to me and to the business along the way. So as I look back, I've worked with hundreds of incredible people over the years and had the blessing of them being around me and learning from them, and hopefully them learning a little bit about me and from me as well. We have interviewed thousands of experts, as I said, people ranging from major politicians to business leaders to athletes like Shaquille O'Neal, John Legend, singer. And so people who are really extraordinary in what they are doing. And I, in the moment, probably when these people were in our studio, it might have felt surreal, and I didn't realize the extraordinary privilege that we and the other people at Big Think had to learn from these people and to share that wisdom with our audience. So as I look back, I just feel extraordinarily blessed and proud of what we at Big Think over the years have built. And I will say that I wish that I had felt that more in the moment and appreciated it as it was going versus as you're now asking me to do in hindsight, which I actually very much appreciate.
Oh, well said. Well said. So Big Think is the main business, the main website, bigthink.com. You can track it down there. There's a ton, well, 13 years of content on there at this point, easily categorized and for you to sift through and search and find what you need. And then there's the new book, So I hate to say this, but I don't know if you're listening to this right now and it's October 6th or beyond, or if it's right before. We're in a 1 week sort of period there. So the book is either out everywhere you can possibly buy a book, online and off, or the book is about to be out.
You can actually buy it now at digitalgoddessbook.com, and it is already on Amazon for pre-orders, so it is available.
So digitalgoddessbook.com?
That's right. But you can also search Digital Goddess on Amazon or other book purveyors, and you will find it. It's available now.
So as a podcast lesson there, you should ask your guest before saying that it is not available, because it absolutely is for pre-order. I mean, plus there's some pre-order things that you can get. There's a video with 8 lessons as well that you can get straight from Victoria as well. So digitalgoddessbook.com, I'll track down that link for you, but you can go there yourself, or you can find it on Hack the Entrepreneur on Victoria's show notes. And then anything else we discussed today, I'll also add it to the list there for you. So it's easy for you to track down once you're at your computer.
I appreciate it so much. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. Victoria, thank you so, so much for stopping by. Thanks for sharing so openly. I truly, truly appreciate it. And just keep doing what you're doing, because it is truly awesome to watch.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I also appreciated learning from you that you're from Toronto. Go Raptors!
All right. Well, that was a lot of fun, as I said it would be. And I hope that you did enjoy it nearly as much as I did, or as I anticipated that you would. I do appreciate you, Victoria, for stopping by. It's very cool of you. And you out there listening, thanks so much for swinging by this way again. Hacktheentrepreneur.com. It's the site. It's where you can find all of this. You can track down Victoria's show notes over there. You can check out the blog. You can get on the email list. You can do anything you'd like over there. You can even check out 101 best business books. I've reviewed 101 business books over there just for you, in short sort of excerpts, so you can sort of digest it and find the best book you want. So if you're into business and you're looking to read, head over to the blog and you'll track it down. All right. Thank you so much. I truly, truly appreciate it. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.